My name is Ken Bakken. The title of the session is Cancer, the Challenge and the Gift, I believe. All right. Start with a scripture from 2 Corinthians 1, 3 to 4. Blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, the Father of mercies and God of all comfort, who comforts us in all our affliction, so that we may be able to comfort those who are in any affliction with the comfort with which we ourselves are comforted by God. Let's pray. Lord, send your Spirit to be here in this place, in and among us. Let us be aware of that as we acknowledge that you are indeed the Creator, the Sustainer, the Healer. In Jesus' name. Amen. The Gospel according to Ken, the sixth chapter of the book here. I want to read you something from this, and then we'll launch into this thing of cancer. This is going to put a context out of which we're going to be speaking about cancer. Indeed, our contemporary quest for health and wholeness must begin in the church and its congregations. The vocation to serve as a healing community has its origin in the life and teachings of Christ. Health in its fullest meaning must no longer be abdicated to those who continue to propound an obsolete worldview. In a study of the healing church and its ministry, the Healthcare Apostolate, prepared for the Lutheran Church in America in 1982, Ralph Peterson, who's a friend of mine and an ordained clergy in the Lutheran Church, challenges us to remember who we are. And Ralph writes, "The recovery of the missionary mandate to healthcare calls us to recover the resurrection life that is ours in the body of Christ. The call to healthcare demands a converted church. A converted church. A church that is healed by the power of the Spirit. Our problem is not that we don't have services of faith healing. Our problem is that we do not live in apostolic faith and experience the healing and hope that come from being an Easter people." Pretty powerful stuff. This is the national statement, 1982. Then I go on to write, "The church has always been involved in innumerable practical actions to treat sickness, especially since the time of the reformers. Christians have established hospitals, clinics, and medical schools wherever missionary groups have gone. But, as Morton Kelsey writes, by a strange quirk of logic, it is permissible to remove medically the results of man's sins, people's sins, but it is not quite correct to believe that God will do it himself if asked in prayer or invoked through the sacraments." We talked a lot about that all week. "The church has tried, most often schizophrenically, to maintain a Cartesian worldview and still claim the ultimate power of God as creator, healer, and sustainer. God becomes either a whimsical cosmic bellhop, a notion that only a weak, if not heretical, theology can support, or is put into a box on the shelf to be protected by liberal or fundamentalist double talk. Christian health practitioners have brought the loving model of Jesus to their work of treating sickness, but generally they are limited by the dogmatic stance of the biomedical model that reduces health to mechanical functioning. They have been unable to deal with the phenomenon of healing satisfactorily." Fritjof Capra, who is a physicist, makes it clear that this is the most serious shortcoming of the biomedical approach. And Fritjof Capra writes, "Although every practicing physician knows that healing is an essential aspect of all medicine, the phenomenon is considered outside the framework scientifically. The term healer is viewed with suspicion, and the concepts of health and healing are generally not discussed in medical schools. And only recently are these concepts beginning to be discussed in the church in earnest. We are now beginning to realize that the functions that are crucial to our health and well-being, integrative activities and interactions with the environment, do not lend themselves to a reductionistic description. By concentrating on smaller and smaller fragments of the body, we have not been able to cure nor even to understand most of today's prevalent diseases and problems. And that comes from me as a public health scientist. As a whole person, ecological systems approach is needed. And Capra goes on to explain, systems theory looks at the world in terms of the interrelatedness and interdependence of all phenomena. And in this framework, an integrated whole, whose properties cannot be reduced to those of its parts, is called a system. Living organisms, societies, and ecosystems all are systems. Healing is possible, in modern scientific terms, when an integrated organism generates a coordinated response to distressful environmental influences. This implies concepts and approaches that transcend the Cartesian split. For the Christian, it implies the transforming and integrating presence of the one in whom we live and move and have our being. That is the beginning of what we need to say in order to get at cancer. Cancer care is in uproar all over the world. There's a lot of power and money and control invested in cancer care and the way it's looked at. And it probably is the symbol, not only of our society, and I'll read some things I've written about that, but also the symbol of the struggle for the soul of medicine. I think it is. It's the second most common cause of mortality and morbidity, if you look at statistics in our country. It's second only to heart disease. In 1986, over 486,000 persons died of cancer and its complications in the United States. Just about 500,000 people. In May of 1986, Dr. John Baylor, an eminent physician, public health scientist, at Harvard University, and Dr. Elaine Smith at the University of Iowa College of Medicine, published a seminal and highly controversial report in the New England Journal of Medicine, one of the world's prestigious medical journals. And they posed the general question, are we winning the war against cancer? Using one statistical yardstick, and that is this, the age-adjusted mortality rate, which adjusts for changes in age distribution as well as population size, and combining all cancer deaths, cancer-related deaths, they found that the overall mortality rate from cancer, that is the death rate from cancer, during the years 1950 to 1982, and this was their retrospective study, that was 32 years, had increased by 8.5%. Increased by 8.5%. In other words, the death rate because of cancer had gone up 8.5% in a period of time in which we have poured billions and billions and billions of dollars into the quote-unquote war against cancer. This had been a particularly intensive time of research and investigation into this disease, to fight this disease. And it's not going down, folks. It's going up, and it's getting worse and worse. Things that we saw rarely, like lymphoma, I see them in younger and younger people, 20s and 30s. It was a rare disease at one time, and now it's very common. Doctors Baylor and Smith expressed strongly the opinion that the war against cancer was only a qualified success, and that's to put it mildly. Admittedly, there have been noteworthy improvements. Okay, there are things that have improved. For instance, the extension of life in persons under 65 years of age, better palliation of symptoms, treatment and control of less known types of cancer. But respected scientists suggest that the amount of progress in cancer control has been overstated at best, and that research emphasis should be shifted from the treatment of cancer, at least as it's now commonly treated, to that of prevention. The National Cancer Institute very recently issued a report stating that the United States could use existing knowledge to cut cancer deaths in half, mind you, by the year 2000. 11 years away, 10 years away. And the key, according to NCI, is getting people to act on what is already known about preventing, screening, and treating cancer. And, of course, we know that there are remarkable breakthroughs worldwide in research and scientific circles in such diverse disciplines as psychoneuroimmunology, that is, the mind-body connection, the connection with the immune system and the neurological aspects of the body, preconscious learning processes, immunology, emotional healing, nutrition. So if 80 to 90% of cancers are preventable, and that's the figure that most public health scientists state, 80 to 90% of all cancers are preventable, then are we not ethically and morally obliged to apply clinically the knowledge that we already have from the laboratory and from diverse disciplines, such as I've mentioned, and from epidemiological studies, which is the study of disease and its causes, and begin to apply that clinically, rather than the very dogmatic biomedical stance that is taken in cancer care right at this present time? That's the question I pose to you. Are we not ethically and morally obliged to do so? The former director of the National Centers for Disease Control, Dr. Bill Fahey, who is a PLU graduate and a Lutheran by birth and stayed so as an adult, who is now director of the Carter Institute in Atlanta, stated when he was still director of the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta that what we need in this country is a second public health revolution. That is a revolution in lifestyle. And who's better to begin to grasp that fully than we who are rooted in the gospel? I mean, the church should be leading in this. We really should be stating the truth of what it means to be whole and healthy people. And then we could truly have a significant impact on diseases such as cancer and heart disease and arthritides and on and on and on. And if you look at the 10 major causes of mortality and morbidity in this country, they are all diseases of lifestyle. In essence, and diseases which we have had very little impact on. A woman in here was just telling me about she'd been diagnosed with a type of arthritis, and a type that we know very little about, where it comes from and how to treat it other than prednisone, and that's very common for these 10 top diseases of lifestyle. Control, yes, but getting at root causes, no. Okay, what's cancer? What causes cancer? We don't really know for certain. There's a lot of theory. One thing we can say about it, it's a group of erratically, randomly, rapidly dividing cells that parasitically invades a tissue or an organ system or systems. And if left untreated, it overwhelms the organism or the organ system, causing disability and premature death. It's a very frightening disease, isn't it? I mean, everybody think of cancer, you think of the big C, and you think of death. You know, I know that from people. It doesn't have to be so, though. Cancer cells are usually immature cells, out of control, not governed by the normal rules of human physiology and cell growth. And in the surveillance theory of cancer, it's been hypothesized that all of us are thought to have aberrant, immature, i.e. cancerous cells in our body, and that are those of us that are healthy and have a good balance of immune system and proper functioning destroy the cancer cells. And when our health is compromised in some manner, the abnormal cells are not recognized by the body's defense mechanisms, and they begin to multiply and spread. So here we're talking really about a chain. There are these links in this chain, whether that be emotional, psychological distress, stress. We know that when you are in a constant fight or flight mechanism, i.e. the adrenaline is pouring out, that begins to have detrimental effects on the organ systems. The adrenal gland gets depleted, and we begin to have ill effects in terms of dis-ease, illness. That's one thing. We're constantly bombarded, and we know from our environmental work this week about toxins in the environment. You know, when Time and Newsweek begin to pick it up, it must be pretty bad. No, it's true, you know, it's kind of... that the vegetables that we think, the cruciform vegetables that we think are good for us are also raised with 50 types of pesticides and that sort of thing, and you begin to wonder what is good to eat. And the food we eat, the air we breathe, and the water we drink, and the ground, and the toxic waste sites, and the on and on and on, that's another a link in that chain. Lack of exercise, all kinds of lifestyle choices, habits such as smoking, abuse of alcohol, drugs. We could go on and on. All links in this chain. You see, it's not as if one becomes a victim. That's, go back to some of my first talks, those of you who've been sort of with me the whole week. That's a witchcraft view of disease. Like it was you're zapped out of the air, all of a sudden, oh, I have cancer, where'd it come from? Now sometimes we just can't pinpoint it. That's true. We wonder why. But it is a disease of lifestyle as well, and it's a disease of corporate and individual choices over generations and or a lifetime. It's a disease of aging. As we age, some faster than others, the immune system is compromised and we're not as resilient. When cancer is discovered in adults, a lot of research says now that it probably has been there from 20 to 25 years. Usually, within in the 2 years prior to its being made manifest, clinically manifest, and causing problems, there was some precipitating event. See this in breast cancer a lot. Some grief unresolved, some tragic event, something has gone on. It's amazing how often that is the case. The cancer or tumor, and oncology, for those of you that don't know that word, is the study of tumors, is the end result of a series of links in this chain of events. And these links, which again to review, include aging, diet, stress, other disease processes, environmental toxins, pollutants, habits such as smoking, excessive alcohol, addictions, all help forge the chain which lead up to cancer. But it's more than a disease. I really feel that cancer is a metaphor for our time. And I wrote something that is rather, I suppose, more poetic than anything else, and I want to share it with you in looking forward to this time together. I wrote, as we have forgotten our roots, our place, as Doug talked about, as we've forgotten our sense of rootedness, as we systematically rape and plunder our Mother Earth, As we cling to the gods of metal for our defense, rather than the God of Abraham, Moses, David, Jeremiah, Jesus, Francis, Luther, Hildegard, King, Dorothy Day, as we push the limits of technology and competition, rather than espouse the hopes of true community and cooperation, as we choose death rather than life, brokenness and woundedness over healing and health, fast lane life, fast foods, and fast religion over fasting, rhythm of life, and authentic spirituality, then it is no wonder that our world, our institutions, our very lives are being systematically eaten away and undermined. There is no magic cure for this malignancy other than to enter into a process of healing. Healing for ourselves, our families, our communities, our world, and the earth on which we live. So I see cancer as, it eats away at our bodies in its most literal form. And it is growing in its prevalence and incidence, but it's also a metaphor for our time. There are five important areas to address with cancer. For one of them, and I suppose very significantly and important, is medically. What are the conventional modalities used to treat cancer care? Chemotherapy. That's the first one that comes to mind. Radiation?
Surgery.
Okay. Is there a fourth modality? Anybody know the fourth modality?
That's
nutrition.
No? It plays into it. It's called immunotherapy. Yeah, it's now being called, even at NCI, the fourth modality of cancer care. Now, it's very important that we understand that chemotherapy, radiation, and surgery are very important modalities and very necessary at times. The unfortunate part about it is that they have been grasped as being the only way for some clinicians. And this is part of the struggle for the soul of treating cancer right now. There are enormous changes taking place worldwide. Chemotherapy is a very important modality at times, but it also destroys the immune system. That we know. When you have these very toxic regimens, which can be very brutal, over a period of time that kill rapidly developing cells, they also kill the rapidly developing cells of the immune system. The T cells and the B cells and the helper cells and natural killer cells and all these things that have to do with the proper dealing with malignant cells as they are in our body. But it's very important when cancer is diagnosed that the tumor be debulked, that the tumor be shrunk, gotten rid of. And that's why we do surgery. That's why we take out a tumor. But each of these has their drawback, and radiation the same thing. Radiation kills cancer cells, but it also kills normal cells, rapidly dividing normal cells in the body, as sophisticated as the technology is at this time. Now, the fourth modality of cancer care, which is coming along quite leaps and bounds, partly because of the AIDS crisis, as we look at the functioning of the immune system. By the way, if any of you are interested, the June 1986 issue of National Geographic has a wonderful part on the immune system, as with the great pictures and how it functions and all of that, as only National Geographic can do with their beautiful color plates. This fourth modality of cancer care has to do with what we call biologic response modifiers. It has to do with the body's innate created order of healing. How the body deals with aberrant cells, bacteria, viruses, cancer cells, all of that. And when a cancer is diagnosed, how to affect that immune system, how to uncover the aberrant tumor cells, because they become hidden in some way from the immune system, put it in lay terms. So that their body recognizes as aberrant, as parasitic, as not of self, so that the immune system is enhanced and supported to go after it. So we have work with interferon, interleukin, all kinds of work with immunosupportive measures like immunoadsorption, which filters the blood of circulating immune complexes. There's all kinds of things. I know I'm throwing out a lot of terms. I'm just giving you some idea of the excitement that's going on worldwide in this area. So medically, yeah, lots of good things need to happen. But that's only part of what it means to really address cancer. And I've heard so many horror stories from people who've said, yeah, I've had surgery and I had chemotherapy, but the way I was told and the way I was treated and then sort of said, go home and either get ready to die or go home and just sort of, well, hopefully you'll be okay, are all too frequent in my history as a physician. And so we began to look at what are the components that people are doing worldwide, other practitioners. There's much happening in Britain and in Europe in general. And what needs to happen to support people when the diagnosis of cancer is made, other than good medical intervention? One of them, of course, is the emotional and spiritual support. And all that we've been talking about all week, all the issues of self-esteem and love and forgiveness, issues of the faith journey. To quote Rocher, says, life is a journey and healing the wounds of life is a necessary and ongoing process in that journey. Discovering the richness of our being is not a luxury. It is a vital necessity if we are to become ourselves fully, to own the positive in us, and to identify with the worthwhile person that we are essentially. Remembering that we are called by God and blessed by God, called by name, held in the palm of God's hand, and loved unconditionally. And there's a lot of self-blaming by people. You know, there's a wonderful book, by the way. Any of you who have not read it, you must. It's Bernie Siegel, acquaintance of ours. We had dinner with him a few months ago. Love, Medicine, and Miracles. Any of you read that? Love, Medicine, and Miracles. Fabulous book. He's a cancer surgeon. And his new book, which is called Peace, Healing, and Love, or something like that. But anyway. Bernie Siegel, S-I-E-G-E-L. A third area, other than the emotional, spiritual, and the medical, is physical fitness and body awareness. It's important that we say for ourselves or for anyone, I don't have a body, I am a body. That's really a profound theological statement, and this comes very much out of the depth of our Judeo-Christian heritage. I don't have a body, I am a body. I'm not a bag of bones sort of from a command center of the nervous system just kind of directing what I do. My body is a reflection of who I am, an integral part of who I am. The body remembers what the mind seemingly does not. Research is showing that truth. Also showing that regular vigorous exercise can enhance our immune system, fight malignant cells, release endorphins from our brain in terms of well-being in general. Movement and physical fitness not only make us feel better and promote health and wellness and longevity, but also help us to reclaim our inner being, our spiritual life. There's much being done with movement therapy, dance therapy, as in conjunction with talk therapy in the counseling process. I'd like to quote from Jean Achterberg, a PhD. She wrote a wonderful book called Healing and Imagery. I can't remember exactly. I think it's Healing and Imagery. She says about this about the body. Nowhere is there such a concrete manifestation of the illusionary stuff that is mind and soul as in the human body. By the way, she's a researcher that does work at the national level around the mind-body connection. It is there in the body, in its state of relative health or sickness, that the harmony of the person is portrayed. The body has no secrets. It never lies. Neither the sins of omission and commission in the environment, nor past and present thoughts, can pass without leaving their corporeal mark. Does everyone understand that? Neither the sins of omission and commission in the environment, nor past and present thoughts, can pass without leaving their corporeal mark. In other words, what happens in the mind and the emotions and the spirit and all of that, what happens to us is remembered. And it can't pass without leaving its corporeal mark in some way. In the immune system, the endorphins, the nervous system comes out of physical disease. Very important part of that. A fourth component of cancer care that we found really important and which is being researched greatly at the present time is the whole area of centering, relaxation, and imagination, imagery work. The brain has the phenomenal capacity to affect change in our bodies. That's being shown over and over again. The whole work with stress. Hans Selye and all the followers after that has shown that very clearly. Again, to mention this long word, psychoneuroimmunology, specialists in this discipline have demonstrated that the brain and the immune system make up a closed circuit. Candace Pert, Albert Rossini, people at the National Institutes of Mental Health and some of the private labs all over the world now are showing that the brain can enhance or inhibit the body's defenses against disease such as infection or cancer. And imagery is the primary, can be one of the primary things affected by those reactions. Also, memories and traumatic negative life experiences can have a negative effect on the body. They're doing work with chemicals that leave an indelible ink or mark, and I write about this in the second book, that somehow leave a tracing that needs to be reprogrammed. And we do that reprogramming in images. Our whole language is based on images. If you read about linguistics and all of that, and now the neurological aspects of linguistics and how we think, how the right brain works and the left brain and all of that, it's all in images. It's all in visual images. And so if negative bodily responses or images can reflect into a negative body response and disease, then concomitantly, and they've been showing this as well, researchers, that positive mental images can have positive effects on the body. Relaxing the body physiologically is necessary to center the mind and the emotions. So that's a vital part of that. And actually what's being done now in the work by Carl Simonton, which goes back many, many years, and he was really castigated as an oncologist to even suggest that relaxation, visualization, imagery work would have an effect on cancer. He and his wife wrote a book called Getting Well Again, in which they write very profoundly about their work with patients in this whole area. The fifth area that is really important in terms of a comprehensive integrated cancer approach is nutrition and diet. The new director for the National Institute of Cancer has now switched the emphasis away from chemotherapeutic treatment to looking at nutrition and its role, not only prevention but in the care of cancer. 30% of the budget now is going to be, NCI is being switched to nutritional research, which is really exciting. One of the, our nutritionist at St. Luke Medical Center has been given a grant, in fact, to look at the literature and what we do know already about the effects of nutrition and cancer. And there's exciting stuff. None of it's definitive yet, but even the American Cancer Society, which is extremely conservative, has these big advertisements in journals and magazines and paper about eating certain kinds of foods, cruciform things. What are the cruciform vegetables?
Broccoli,
cabbage, cauliflower, Brussels sprouts. Yeah, you bet. Why? Showing the connection between lack of fiber, lack of that kind of vegetable in terms of colon cancer. We know now that high-fat diets and high-fat content in the body has a lot, epidemiologically, from a public health point of view, to do with breast cancer. You look at populations such as the Japanese in terms of heart disease and cancer, it's very different traditionally than American diet, which, by the way, is about 40 to 50% fat. The average Japanese diet is about 18 to 20% fat. We advocate a diet under 20% fat. We eat horribly. The traditional American diet is literally killing us. Literally. It's no wonder our immune systems are screwed up. 70% of the American population is chromium deficient. This is all public health stuff. Most clinicians don't know this. We are deficient in selenium in some places, and some people get too much selenium. But selenium has been identified now as a very vital component in terms of cancer care. The Japanese have released germanium. And quercetin, which comes out of garlic and onions to treat cancer. What's happening in Asia, in the industrialized Asian countries, and in Europe, we're still laughed at in this country. I mean, it's rather absurd. There is almost an arrogance about how we do certain things medically. And what we're finding is that we just can't take in anything in terms of refined foods or whatever, as was the conventional wisdom just up until a few years ago, that we could take in any kind of foods and it would be broken down by the body and utilized in the same way as any other food. That's absolute nonsense. So people who were laughed at a few years back, even such sort of faddish pop people as Adele Davis and all of them, you start looking back at their old books that came out in the 50s, some of that stuff's right on. Stuff that was poo-pooed. And so it's very important to begin to do reading. And this is very important. Nutrition's a vital part of prevention. It really is you are what you eat. That's why I think, despite some of the room for improvement here at this dining room, at least the beginning is coming in terms of low on the food chain, high fiber. I know a lot of us have been complaining about being bloated, and our guts aren't used to
all those beans.
All those beans, yes. Gassing each other out. Anybody have a question about those five areas? Then I want to relate a story from my book. Yes.
What about vitamins?
Oh, supplementation. Yeah, that's part of nutrition. See, there's so much pop fad about that you got to be careful. There is about all these areas. That's the risk, you see. But again, I feel, to go back to one of my first statements, that we're ethically and morally obliged to begin to use in various disciplines what has already been proven in the clinic and in experience to be useful. Primum non nocere. First, do no harm. That is the physician's oath. What do we do so often? We dump stuff into people and do stuff to people that is very harmful. So a lot of these things don't do any harm, but may do a lot of good, based on the research and clinical work that's being done worldwide. To get to vitamin supplementation, yeah, if you do an RBC, a red blood cell, trace element analysis on a lot of people, you see, and that's the best way to look at it, because that's what's incorporated into the cellular structure of the body, one way to measure it, you see manganese, magnesium, selenium, chromium deficiencies, and other kinds of deficiencies. And so you need to find out, why isn't it being assimilated? What kinds of foods are they taking? And how do you need to supplement that, whether cancer has been diagnosed or not? It's a very important aspect of it, and it's a very important growing research scientific way of looking at things. Not just to dump in a multiple vitamin, you know, for the day. I don't think the Lord created us that we had to take all that stuff, but the fact of what we've done to our agricultural lands and our environment and all that, there is a need, I think, for some supplementation for a lot of people at times. So that's a whole other topic in and of itself, and I'm not so sure I'm the one to talk about it. One of our physicians at St. Luke would be much more in tune with that. He's a clinical nutritional specialist. But
is interferon being used?
Yes, absolutely. Marvelous research with interferon. It's only officially released for treatment of certain type of leukemia, hairy cell leukemia, but we're using it in a protocol from the University of Tennessee in our cancer program in all cancers for boosting the immune system and enhancing the immune system. It's very exciting.
It's very expensive.
No, it isn't. No, it's in fact, it's $25 for a bottle for 3 million units, and now we're using... It's expensive if you use the maximum tolerable dose, which is way up in the 30 to 40, 50 million units. But if you use the minimum effective dose, which we're finding in the research with interferon, that's much better, with much fewer side effects, if any, it's not that expensive to do. So, anyone else? Question?
Yeah. I had a question on the immunotherapy. They don't do that everywhere. Where are they doing that, and why can it only be used on some kinds of cancer and not all?
As is typical...
Can you repeat this question?
Yes. She was asking about immunotherapy. Why is it not being done everywhere, and why is it only with certain types of cancer? As it is with most cancer, most disease processes, and in the medical world, biomedical sciences, we develop protocols in order to protect the public from stuff that may or may not be useful or may or may not be harmful. So that's also the drawback, because when things have loosened up for AIDS patients, but because nothing has worked. So these long investigative prospective studies, double-blind studies and all of that, which have come under criticism, by the way. Double-blind studies aren't all what they're cracked up to be. There's great value in the one case study. Why did it work for so-and-so? And that's what we're finding with interferon and some other things. Why is it working for a large percentage of people with breast cancer or whatever, you see? It's not being done because immunotherapy really is part of the new shift in how to look at treating everything. And not everybody is looking at it the same way and saying, well, I'm going to wait until it's really, quote unquote, proven before I'll even get into it. Or certain centers are doing it, like Sloan Kettering or MD Anderson or Swedish Hospital in Seattle or, you know, whatever.
How would you get yourself to that center if you really believed in that?
There are some places like CanHelp, which is run by a fellow who is a correspondent for Newsweek. He has computerized where all the studies are being done and where all the alternative stuffs are being done. And you can, for $300, get a computer printout of all of that. And it depends on who's open-minded. There are a lot of oncologists and people doing psychosocial and immunological oncology, like we're doing at St. Luke's. that are aware of folks like Jean-Yves Douillard, who is a French scientist, the world's leading authority on monoclonal antibodies, which has a lot to do with cancer. He's in Nantes, France. He's getting remarkable results with colon cancer, with monoclonal antibodies. People that were told to be dead in 6 months, they're getting well, totally. And in fact, we're having him, hopefully, for a seminar next year. But if you know these things and people can afford it, you send them to France for 3 weeks and you go get it done. Or there's somebody doing it in Pittsburgh that's using his protocol, but you have to stay there for 6 weeks, and some people can't do that. You have to begin to read, you have to begin to ask, you have to begin to get informed, and it's sometimes hard to do. Anybody else?
What about the macrobiotic diet?
The question is about macrobiotic diet. That's a lifestyle in essence. Comes from Asia, from Japan, and it's very hard for North Americans to do because it has a lot of seaweeds and sea vegetables and all that kind of stuff, and it tastes so foreign to our palate that it's very difficult to maintain it. I think more importantly would begin, what we do with people is usually put them on a vegetarian diet and then gradually increase some protein to the appropriate amount. And the same effect can be achieved. And then if you come out of a truly Christ-centered approach to it all and the people are into that, then the spiritual aspects and all the other aspects can be dealt with in that way, rather than just sort of a generic spirituality of getting in tune with the cosmos or whatever. Anybody else? Okay. This is a story about... This was a powerful example of reclaiming health. A cancer patient. And it's in here, and it's all changed to protect the privacy of this person. But I want to read it because it shows what can happen. It's a one case, it's an anecdote. It's not a study, it's just an anecdote. And the reason I say this is because cruelly, so often, we as physicians say to people, well, according to the statistics, you have a 5% chance of living. So go home and get ready, or 90% of the people die in a year with this and that cancer, or whatever. Well, you know what the deep brain does, the deep consciousness? Takes it right in and says, oh, I'm going to be dead in 6 months. And they die right on schedule. So what I've begun to start doing is say, let's not focus on what the statistics say. Okay, you want to know them, all right, that's okay, we'll go through it. And then we immediately get onto a different jag, a hope. In fact, you can take a card, like a business card, of plain paper, and stipple all the area that is the non-hope. And then it leaves a window, a square window of what may be 20% hope. And that window looks pretty big. When you stipple out the 80%, you leave that 20% window. That's pretty big. And I'd say, shoot for that window. Let's visualize going through that window. Let's look at who survived and not who just died, you see, with that same disease. And that makes a big difference in people's lives. Because all of a sudden there's some hope. And that's not false hope. That's real hope. There are people who survive even the worst cancers, i.e. pancreatic cancer or oat cell carcinoma of the lung or whatever. But this is a...
Norman Cousins approach.
Yeah. Laughter and... high doses of vitamin C.
What do you think?
Oh, I think for some things it's absolutely fantastic. He teaches at UCLA about this very stuff. A powerful example of this is Helen, a widow in her late 40s. Helen was a giver. For years, she had expended herself in loving service to others, first to her family, then through her job and many volunteer activities. She had not, however, properly responded to her own emotional and physical needs. Helen was viewed as a healer, but she had lost her own balance. Helen's lifestyle, improper diet, lack of physical exercise and play, failure to love and nurture herself, took its toll. As she continued to ignore the distress signals, the dialogue among body, mind, and spirit became increasingly more dysfunctional. She had also lost the immediate experience of her Christian faith, a faith that had been central in her life. Exhaustion and fear ruled, So much so that for weeks she completely ignored increasing pain, weakness, weight loss, and a growing abdominal girth, making her appear like a pregnant woman at 9 months. Finally, through the urgings of a friend, she realized the seriousness of her situation and presented herself to a local hospital. A diagnosis was made of advanced ovarian cancer. Tests revealed a tumor the size of a volleyball and metastases to the liver and other parts of the abdomen. There was a large quantity of fluid in the abdominal cavity and in the lungs, and the physicians told Helen that even if she survived surgery, which they doubted, she would probably not live more than a few weeks. About a month after surgery, a weak, emaciated, but very much alive Helen arrived in our office. Helen was determined to get well again. There was much more for her to accomplish in this life, she said, and she knew that she would be healed. That was very interesting. She was tenacious. Helen told us that she had declined any further conventional cancer therapy, much to the chagrin of her physicians. Now, I also suggested that we do a lot of other things. Now, she came from out of state, and she moved to where we were. I mean, it happened to find what we were doing, which includes conventional cancer therapy, okay? We have an oncologist on staff. Much to the chagrin of her physicians, and that by the grace of God, she had uncovered the reasons for her illness. She had taken responsibility for her illness and was willing to make the necessary changes in her life. Helen then put herself entirely into God's hands. Now, much of this she did herself, okay? She actively embraced her disease and learned from it. She changed her diet, began a fitness program, spent hours each day in prayer and meditation, supported throughout by caring family and friends. As she was increasingly filled with the healing light of what she called my lover, the Christ, it's beautiful, my lover, the Christ, Helen believed that there was less and less room for the cancer cells to divide and grow. We did little medically except to strengthen her immune system with biologic response modifiers and to facilitate lifestyle interventions. And after 6 months, all tests showed normal. The blood work, including the helper T cell to suppressor cell lymphocyte ratio, the chest X-ray, the CT scans, and the tumor markers. The real work of integration and healing had been Helen's and God's. Soli Gloria Dei. To God be the glory. One example of what happened. An advanced stage 4 ovarian cancer, by all objective evidence, well. Why? Who knows? Except that I related to you what she did. I see people who do that too and who die. Okay? We all do, don't we? Okay. I would like to suggest 10 areas in which you perhaps should take up the challenge that the diagnosis of cancer poses. This is the challenge. 1, seek healing, not just a cure. This goes back to a lot of stuff we've been talking about all week. Seek healing, not just a cure. 2, live fully the now moment. Live fully the now moment. All cancer patients who are on the healing recovery route and who have taken it seriously say that they have learned to live the now moment. 3, seek change and growth. Be transformed in body, mind, and spirit. Romans 12:1, be transformed by the renewing of your mind. 4, seek to live without fear and anxiety, fear of pain, fear of death, fear of fear. Helen learned to embrace her fear, to move right through it. 5, become whole, not perfect. Become whole, not perfect. 6, take responsibility for your life. Become proactive rather than reactive. Don't be a victim, clinging to false securities. 7, learn to play and laugh and become childlike. Learn to play and laugh and become childlike. 8, make positive choices in lifestyle that are life-giving, not life-denying. What may be positive choices for you may not be for another. 9, learn to love and forgive unconditionally. Learn to love, these are hard, aren't they? Learn to love and forgive unconditionally. 10, live in the question. Live in the question. And I want to leave you with a quote from Rainer Maria Rilke, famous poet, theologian. It says, be patient toward all that is unsolved in your heart and try to love the questions themselves like locked rooms and like books that are written in a very foreign tongue. And the point is to live everything. Live the questions now. Perhaps you will then gradually, without noticing it, live along some distant day into the answer. Yes?
Cancer has gift, you said at the start.
The gift is learning to take up the challenge. And I have heard those who have taken up the challenge in those 10 points say to me, I am glad I have cancer or had cancer because I have learned to be whole and live for the first time in my life. And whether I have 1 year or 25 years left, I am glad I had cancer. That's an amazing thing for people to say, but I've heard it over and over again. You see, what people with cancer are immediately confronted with, the same things we're confronted with. It's just more immediate. Your own mortality, your own death. I take people through, who have cancer, I take them through death and dying, their own death. That's the first thing we do. Let's just admit it, we're going to die. Whether it's 6 months from now, like you've been told, or 60 years from now, it doesn't matter, we're going to die. We don't get out of this alive. And so let's deal with it. I use Anthony DeMello's work on fantasy on a corpse. It's all gross, but it's wonderfully powerful. Imagine yourself dying, your own funeral, your own death and your own decay in the tomb, to dust. From dust we come and to dust we return. It's all biblical, folks. That's what it's all about, is learning to live well. And the only way you can learn to live fully is to address and confront your own death. And that's for all of us. And that is the fear that most of us live with. That is the most horrible fear we have, is that, what if I get that and I die? Or my wife, or my child, or whatever. And I heard a theologian say once, maybe what we are about in life is learning to grieve well. The little things. Stepping on my hamster when I was a kid and breaking its back, or, you know, and bawling my eyes out. And how that's handled by my parents means a lot when my mother died at age 60 suddenly. So learn to grieve well. Face your own death. Know that it's immediate, whether you have cancer or whether you die at a ripe old age of 120 like Moses with full sexual potency, like we talked about the first time. Anyone else? Yes.
For what it's worth, I think I've come out where you are describing, but I didn't know why. I've had 2 cancer surgeries, and the last one was 14 years ago. And just living the moment and so forth, and rejoicing in the gift of every day and every friend and whatever. It's a glorious thing the Lord's given me.
Thank you.
I didn't know how I got there.
I hope this gave a few guidelines for you. You can help your friends with it. And family. Anyone else? From the peanut gallery? Thanks so much. It's been a blessing for me to be here with you.